America should be grateful to God for the blessings he's given us.
Don't let anyone tell you that America's best days are behind her.
We have got to fight for this nation because I believe with all my heart this nation is in fact one nation under God.
Welcome back, Financial Issues. I'm Dan Celia. It's great to be here. 610-363-1110. You know, I'm going to go back to phones, but I just wrote a note here that maybe next hour I'll talk a little bit more about preferreds, because I think there's a general lack of understanding. I don't want there to be. If you're a partner, you probably have a pretty good understanding because you've watched my videos and been on a lot of conference calls. Also, you know by now that there have been several preferreds that are on my list, my broad list, that I've taken off. And you know the reason why, because they had a decision. Oh, actually, one came back on because they changed back over to being cumulative. But they stopped being cumulative. I took them off the list because that's kind of, there's nothing wrong with not being, and I told everybody, don't sell what you have. That's not what I wanted to do. I just didn't want people buying new money into those when they should be focused on the other ones that are on our buy list. But there's nothing wrong with it. These are good, solid companies if they're on my list. They're good, solid companies. The odds of them not paying a dividend are probably pretty slim, but there's always that possibility. And being the stick-in-the-mud conservative that I am, I kind of just take them off my list. Why do I take them off my list? Because I don't trust any of you. That's why. So I'm just, because we've had this conversation. I've had it with my partners in town hall meetings. But you, no matter what, you all, and you're all guilty of it. You go to my broad list, and you say, oh, man, I look at that dividend it's paying. I'm just going to buy it. I know it's not on the buy list. And then you call me and say, well, the stock really is not doing so well. And I say, and I have to say, well, that hasn't been on my buy list for 2 years. You've had it for a year and a half. You must have bought it off the broad. Well, yeah, I did. I mean, I hear that all the time. It messes up the strategy, folks. You're not staying within the system. The reason why, and I say this all the time, that I have had some success in the whole management side of things over so many years is because I'm incredibly disciplined to a fault. I'm very, very disciplined. I don't waver. It is what it is. So when we had our trust company, you know, we'd have investment meetings every Monday morning. And so the guys would come in and girls that would come in, and we would kick around certain stocks. So we'd kick them around. We'd talk about them. They'd give me some input. I'd give them some input, so on and so forth. And that's what we decided. We decided as what would go on the buy list for the week, you know, and what we were going to do. And we did that usually on Monday morning. And most of us, myself and some of the other guys, would have done some homework on it over the weekend or Friday or whatever. But we looked at that, and we would make that decision. And so everybody that was involved in touching anybody's portfolio, we were always on the same page. Right. We knew what our buy list was every week. Nobody else knew. They didn't need to know. And we made decisions based on that. So, you know, we would talk about so many different things, and one of those things are, you know, were in and around some of these issues that I talk about, preferred, biblically responsible, and all those kinds of things. The difference was back then we didn't have the technology, so we didn't have as many stocks. It was easier. But there would always be somebody would come up and lobby. One of the guys would come up and lobby that we need to put this stock on the buy list. And I would say, look, it doesn't make it. You know, it doesn't cut the screens for now, and we can't do it. And sometimes they would win. They would make a really strong argument from a fundamental perspective that why we should add it. And sometimes they would win. But, you know, I look at those very, very closely now. And it was interesting because they were always going at a blind, because I never shared all my analytics with anybody. Right. So they weren't privy to all the information. So, you know, they would make an argument against something I knew I couldn't do. And I would just have to say, hey, you're going into that, you know, area we don't talk about. And they all understood it, but why we did that.
And I can understand how people, you know, look at the broad list. You know, you even say it all the time. You know what you have, and they're talking to their friends, and their friends have something X, Y, and Z, but they got into it at the right time. And they're saying, well, I'm missing out.
Right.
But the timing is off.
Right.
So follow the list.
Yeah, and there's you know, thousands and thousands of stocks.
Yep.
We have 200 of them on the list. You know, so obviously there are some companies out there doing great.
Great. Yep.
I probably have right now about 32, 33, I'm trying to think, but somewhere in that neighborhood of stocks that are on my review list. So what that means is no stock gets added to my list for at least 6 quarters.
Right.
I got to have 6 quarters of review. And so they're the stocks that I'm waiting for the next quarter results to be able to go through what I need to go through. Right. And I see how they make it through that quarter. And then I'll go on to the next quarter.
And that's key.
And some of them are 7 and 8 quarters before they end up on. And some of them never make it.
Right.
But that's, so I always have those. All right, we've got our ag report coming up, folks. We're going to get right back to phone. So here's Craig Haugert. Boy, I'll tell you, the commodities, the ag commodities, more important than ever.
Yes.
Still a lot of emphasis on them. Here's Craig. We'll be right back.
This is Craig Haugert with your Financial Issues Ag Update. Well, the corn market traded both sides yesterday, with support coming from hopes of improving demand and renewed buying interest. Pressure in the corn market came from weather forecasts, which are suggesting more rain this week across parts of the Midwest. Now, we all know that rain makes grain, but this crop is in much need of some extended heat units as well. The lateness of the crop was reflected in Monday afternoon's crop progress report, which showed 27% of the crop dented, which is well behind the 59% dented at this point last year, as well as the five-year average of 46%. The overall condition of the crop did improve by 1% last week to stand at 57% good to excellent. The five-year average on this date for the crop is for it to be at 69% good to excellent. As I record this, the overnight spot corn futures are trading unchanged. The soybean market traded higher on crop concerns and renewed buying interest. This week's expected rain event should be beneficial to the developing soybean crop, but the crop really needs some warmer temperatures to get it to full maturity. The crop conditions improved by 2% over last week to stand at 55% good to excellent, but the crop continues to lag in maturity with just 70% of the crop setting pods versus the five-year average of 91%. In the overnight trade, spot soybean futures are trading 6 cents lower. The wheat market traded lower on ample world supplies and a stronger U.S. dollar. Some areas made great strides in harvesting spring wheat last week, while others just barely got started. 38% of the spring wheat crop is now harvested, which is up from 16% a week ago, and that harvest pressure is keeping pressure on prices. In the overnight trade, Chicago is a half cent lower, Kansas City is unchanged, and Minneapolis is up a penny. Cotton futures suffered through another losing session, with the December futures down 39 cents to close at 57.82. The weekly crop conditions report shows a crop that's losing ground as it gave up 6 points in the last week and now stands at 43% good to excellent. In the overnight trade, however, spot futures are trading 20 points lower as I record this. Livestock futures followed up a bad performance on Friday with a great Monday showing. October live cattle futures finished the day $1.60 higher, while September feeder cattle were $2.75 higher at the closing bell. Lean hog futures had a huge day. After being down to $3 limit on Friday, they were operating with extended limits, and as hope was extended that we may be reaching agreement with China, the October futures responded by closing up the extended limit of $4.50. Class 3 milk futures posted a stronger close at the start of the week, with September futures up 3 points as they settled at $17.25, and the overnight trade spot futures are trading unchanged. The cash livestock markets really didn't give us much to cheer about yesterday. The day ended with choice beef boxes 54 cents higher as they settled at $2.38.06, while selects were $1.05 lower for the day as they closed at $2.11.66. In hogs, the pork carcass values finished 66 cents lower to settle at $78.99 per hundredweight. This has been Craig Haugard with your Financial Issues Ag Update. We'll be right back with more financial issues after this.
At
Welcome back, Financial Issues. 610-363-1110. 610-363-1110. If you want to queue your call, you're welcome to do it. 610-363-1110. 610-363-1110. Hey, don't forget social media. If you want to put your questions up there on social media, you can do that. We'll get to those. We'll get to those calls as those questions. So you can go to Facebook. You can go to our website now. By the way, folks, if you watch on the website, you see that little sidebar. You've never been able to enter a question. You can now, because when that was originally set up, it was set up for partners only. Well, I didn't want that. Our web designer assumed I wanted it. I didn't want it. And that was set up. And then we had to unset it. And it took some time to get that done, apparently. But you can put your question up there. So we would love for you to put your questions up there. That'd be great. So you can do that by just going to financialissues.org. If that's where you watch the program, you can go there and go to financialissues.org, and you can put your questions up if that's where you're watching the program. So we would like for you to do that if you can. Somebody's asking, Bill, I think I answered this question, Bill. Maybe you didn't hear it, but Bill asked me a question yesterday. We talked a week ago about CD77. I still have 100K to invest, and I'll answer this for the last time, Bill, but hopefully you hear it or you go back and listen to the podcast. But yeah, I think you ought to start putting it in. I know you're 60, but look, put in, you know, a couple thousand dollars a month, dollar cost average it in on a regular basis. Try to get through. There are some sectors that aren't on the buy list. If there's a sector that's not on the buy list, you don't buy it. It doesn't mean you don't want it. You want the sector, but you've got to wait it out until something in that sector appears before you go ahead and buy it. So that means you've got a little bit more in your cash position than you would like to have or that you should have according to the asset allocation model. It's okay. It's okay. Just leave it in there, because keep checking the buy list, and any day something in that particular sector that you don't have that you need is going to show up. You don't put your full position in that one stock, but it gives you a starting place and you can start buying into that position. Let me go to Tony from Mississippi. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Dan. How you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
I'm a brand new partner. I want to thank you for your ministry. I just had a couple quick questions on how to get started. I've got about $15,000 in a Roth IRA that I want to use to kind of get my feet wet. I understand the allocation model and the buy versus the broad list.
Okay.
I'm just unsure how to get started as far as, are there certain sectors I need to purchase first, or do I need to try to evenly distribute it to kind of get started?
How old are you, Tony?
39.
So are you contributing on a regular basis, or you're trying to build up to that?
I'm contributing to my 401k, and it's actually okay. Fully funded for the year.
Okay, gotcha.
And I have some new money as well in savings that I want to invest, but I thought I would get started with this Roth because it's sitting all in a money market.
Okay, so what you want to do is, I wouldn't be too concerned about dollar cost averaging it in. It's always a good thing to do, but because you're 39, you've got a little bit more leeway. So, I mean, I would certainly take, just because of the volatility we're in is crazy, but the volatility is so volatile that the odds are that you stand just as much of a chance of dollar cost averaging up as you do dollar cost averaging down. Based on the day that you buy it, the way things are going. But I would say that I would start with probably the beaten up sectors, maybe energy, consumer staples. They've really not weathered any kind of storm very well. consumer staples, kind of counterintuitive that it isn't weathering better, but that gives us some insight and maybe a notion that things aren't as bad as we might be led to believe they are. But I would look at those two sectors probably as a starting point to jump in. And, you know, keep rotating from sector to sector. So what you want to do is start out with one or two sectors, maybe start out with those two with some of that money. Wait a month, start two more sectors, and wait a month and start another, and then just start the rotation through again. And I think that's probably going to serve you really well.
Should after I've invested the money in the Roth, should I wait for a while with any new money, putting any new money in the market?
No, especially since you're adding to what you already have built. I wouldn't have a problem waiting. If you were, you know, 69, I would say, yeah, you know, just relax, sit tight. I probably would have told you to stretch the money you have out to 6 or 8 months, dollar cost average in, and maybe hold off on any new money. But in your case, I wouldn't be that concerned. I would continue to build that portfolio on a very consistent basis. You know, you've got a long-term outlook, I hope. And as long as you have that long-term outlook, you've got emergency savings taken care of. Look, there are, you know, we have got to get to a place that we are not following the herd mentality. You know, as everybody's getting out, we got to be looking for areas to get in. And that's what I'm trying to do every week with my buy list. You know, I'm trying to look at, you know, every time there's a downturn and every time there's a panic and every time even institutional investors are dumping and getting out and moving to safety, it's going to mean some wonderful buying opportunities for some people that have new money to put to work and still have a very long time, long-term time horizon. So in your place where you are right now, as long as you have a good, solid emergency savings, I would just keep going through thick or thin. I would not stop no matter how bad things get. I would adopt the attitude that the worse things get, the more you celebrate because you're able to accumulate more shares for the same amount of money that you might have put in otherwise. And just keep plugging along. And that is what is going to serve you really well.
Thank you. And just one more quick question.
Sure.
As far as individual stocks, I think you call them foundational stocks, the ones in yellow.
Sir. Yes.
How do those play into this? Do I buy those individual stocks first in the sectors?
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think that's a good plan, especially now, to buy those. I would look at making sure that where I have them, I don't have them in every sector, but what in the sectors I have them, I would want, that's a great place to build your foundation, to build your portfolio on those stocks. They're the stocks you're never going to sell, you know, you're not going to ever take profit on, you're never going to rearrange, you're never going to care what they do as far as up or down goes, and you know, you're just going to plug along on those. Maybe every once in a while you'll have opportunity to dollar cost average down. This is a great time. I'm thinking of two particular foundational stocks in the ones in the material section, ones in the industrial sector, and two great foundational stocks. Well, you know what I would say, all of the foundational stocks in both those sectors, great time to be getting into.
Great. Dan, thank you so much. I really had sought God about where to invest, and I know he led me to you guys, so thank you very much.
I appreciate that, Tony. I'm glad you're with us. Thank you so much. Good stuff. Let me go to Rob. Rob's calling us from Alabama. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Dan. Hey, thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
You know, I'm an armchair economist. I just find it fascinating, but I don't know much about it, but I still enjoy it. And I've been puzzled by the crazy lows in the oil and gas and exploration sector relative to the price of a barrel of oil. And a friend of mine is, I know a lot of people are because she subscribes to a oil and gas specialist firm, and they've been dead wrong. And I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on why are some of these huge companies on nearly lifetime lows? I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah, well, I mean, in defense of the gas and oil experts, which I seldom defend, but I'll defend them. You know, so many of these organizations like that are so driven by technicals. And listen, we're not living in that world in the gas and oil sector. There's so much geopolitical issues at play here. And look, I think that the geopolitical events can set investors apart from other investors if they are understanding and begin to look at those issues a little bit closer. It's a hard thing for some analysts to do. I get it. I understand. It's easier for me because I'm a behavioral economist. So this is right, you know, that kind of puts me in my wheelhouse of behavior. And what you're seeing is reaction and behavior that companies aren't taking as a result of the geopolitical events, but it's behavior they're engaging in because they have to, because of the geopolitical events that are going on around the globe. And that's driving everything right now. You got to remember that China is the number one importer of oil in the world. They also are the number one user of oil. And they also don't have any oil. They got all that land, and they don't have any oil to speak of. So when you understand how important manufacturing and industrial kinds of things are to oil, they suck up a lot of oil. You can't run these factories and the manufacturing the way they do without sucking up a lot of oil. So when their economy turns down, it gives you a real insight as to what's happening with gas and oil prices. And we are in a rare situation. Productivity continues to get cut and continue to slow, and prices continue to go down. And it tells us that China's a lot worse off than everybody says they are.
I pray that I can.
So let me just elaborate a little bit on what Rob had asked me in reference to the oil. It is amazing how these prices continue to drop. And the one thing that people always ask is, there's really doesn't seem like, why is it when oil prices go down, we don't see that direct correlation at the pump? Or when oil prices go up, we see it a lot quicker. Look, when supply is low and demand is high, the numbers get really out of whack because there's two things happening. We've got supply okay, all right? Supply may even be up. But the only way they're going to slow demand is through raising prices. And so prices go up to disincentivize people, industries, manufacturers, economies, global economies, in international industries to slow down production in whatever they do so that they can slow down their cost, you know, their cost for energy. If you look at chemical companies, their number one raw material is oil, most of them. So pricing, they're very sensitive to that. And so there's so many things at play with oil. It's not new, by the way. It's been like this. The geopolitical events have been exacerbated greatly, as the United States has become the number one oil producer in the world. But we aren't at a place like OPEC was. We have other things going on. OPEC, we have been a slave to OPEC since the 1970s. OPEC controlled the oil market. They dictated, they could get any price they wanted. Those days are gone right now. So the entire oil sector is trying to find a new equilibrium. They're trying to find a balance where we never had to worry about balance because OPEC was dictating everything. Let me give you a good example. If we go back to the last 2 years of the Bush administration, I don't know if you remember this, but in the last 2 years of the Bush administration, in that first year of the last 2 years, we had the highest gasoline prices we've ever had. The average national average for gasoline was $4.11. And so George Bush says, all right, here's the deal, EPA. This is my, George Bush's EPA. Says to the EPA, we are going to drill, drill, drill. Remember that? We're going to drill, drill, drill. We're going to drill all over the place. Anywhere we can drill, we're going to drill. And if somebody applies for a permit, we're going to give them a permit. Let's make sure they get the permit. Let's make sure we drill. Let's make sure we do all of that because I'm sick of this. We're going to increase our supply. As he was speaking, just about as he was speaking, the price of Brent crude oil was dropping like a rock. Why? Because OPEC played this game since the 1970s that they got these exorbitant prices for their oil. And soon as we pushed back and started talking about green energy, start talking about adding supply, they would lower the price because every time they lowered the price, it disincentivized us from doing all of that. It didn't work this time. So what happened was they were dropping prices. We went all the way down to $1.90 a gallon. That's how fast it dropped because OPEC was dropping their price so much, trying to get us to stop this nonsense of drilling everywhere. But what happened was the permits were already getting applied for as quick as you could possibly imagine. And then 3 to 4 years later, President Obama takes all the credit for the oil glut when he would have never done it because he wasn't even willing. He wasn't giving a permit to anybody, but it was too late. The permits were already applied for and issued. But you know how that takes. It takes years for companies to actually get up and going. So then BP happens. The Obama administration, it has a mantra that is well known, that wasn't well publicized. Keep it in the ground. Keep it in the ground. If it was a fossil fuel, they didn't want it out of the ground. Here was the problem. Now you'll remember me ranting about this. I ranted about this for years. That we were in deep, deep debt in the country. Yep. We had major problems, and we had an administration that was keeping it all on the ground. But here's the problem. The administration was giving up 17.5% on a barrel of oil. That was the royalty that the government got for drilling on federal land. And they got 17.5% a barrel. They were giving that up, which, by the way, well, added with the lease payment for the land that they were getting every month, it added up to $1 trillion worth of revenue. I remember when I first started to talk about it, it was $350 billion, and it quickly went to $1 trillion. Nobody cared. That's $1 trillion that the Treasury Department wasn't getting into their coffers. So we were giving that up. The problem was, for the Obama administration, who I believe wanted this to happen, the problem was called a free market economy. That was the problem. And the free market economy, the oil company said, hey, you know what? We don't need this stinking federal land anymore. We've got permits. So they can't stop us from drilling on private property. And we don't need it. If we can't drill, if they're not going to reopen wells and they're not going to let us, we don't care. And they went out and do what private sectors do. they try to capitalize on what was going on, which they did very well, made a ton of money. So from that moment on, so I'm going to say 2008, 9, 10, 11, from 2012, 2013, somewhere in that neighborhood on, the whole dynamic of balance in oil changed. OPEC was sitting there saying, what are we going to do? Because for 4 years now, or then, 3 years then, they were dipping into their sovereign wealth fund, Saudi Arabia anyway, the leader, dipping into their sovereign wealth fund trying to support their economy. They got nothing. OPEC doesn't have anything. They got sand. So that's it. Unless they think about, I'm going to be the greatest glass manufacturer in the world. I mean, they didn't have anything. They got oil. Everything was dependent upon. OPEC needed $120 a barrel to make their budget. Wasn't going to happen. Russia, who's bankrupt for all practical purposes then and now, they needed $180 a barrel, which they weren't getting then and weren't ever going to see it. And they still need $110, in my opinion, to have some sort of a decent economy. OPEC's down to about $80 a barrel now that they need, and they can't get that. So why? Because we, who are always getting accused by the American people, or we're manipulating the oil prices, the American oil companies aren't willing to manipulate the oil prices. They're not saying, hey, let's stop all the pumping, drive the prices up to $100 a barrel. They're not doing it. And, you know, there's no predictability there. What they're doing is becoming more effective, more efficient, more technology-driven, still making money on the oil, and now we are exporting oil, which I was the only free market capitalist that was against exporting oil. That's a whole other story. I ranted about that, and I still am, but we're doing it now, and that's a good thing. So now we have people like China importing West Texas Intermediate that's cheaper than or as competitive as Brent crude oil, readily available. We can get it over there to them. And other countries now... the greatest salesman that there's ever been for nat gas, President Donald Trump, literally. I mean, if he was a salesman for nat gas, he'd be a billionaire just on his commissions. Because everywhere he goes, he says, we got nat gas. We want to sell you. We're ready to do it. Trying to cut deals with Poland and Eastern Europe and everywhere, trying to sell our nat gas. We just can't keep up with the production of the nat gas from a processing standpoint, and the ships have to be refitted and things like that. We now have four ports now shipping nat gas. We will be the number one exporter of nat gas before long, and I believe it's going to be the number one exporting product in the United States of America someday. But so anyway, boy, that was a lot of stuff.
That's a good prediction, and it's helping, you know, lots of folks in the local economies that are working on that now. So we're seeing growth in all those areas that are doing that.
And you're right. We are seeing growth in those areas, those folks that are taking advantage of it. Yep. So I can't answer, you know, when somebody asks me, you know, what's changed. It is the whole dynamic of getting oil in balance has changed. And I don't see that. It's never going to go back to where it was. Is it going to change some more? Yeah. It is going to change some more. But I don't see it going back to where it was. So anyway, we're still playing. I'm not an oil expert, but I've really worked hard from the behavioral aspect of size to get a handle on that. I think we've done a pretty good job. I've been wrong maybe as much as anybody, but maybe not. Maybe I've been right a little bit more than I'm happy to say I've been right sometimes. Let's just put it that way. So, but I'm looking at different matrix than a lot of others are looking at. I'll keep doing that. But unfortunately, the oil companies, they need to change their matrix a little bit. I'm here. I'll give it to them for nothing if they want to keep our economy strong. All right, we'll be back right after this.
Opinions and recommendations expressed by Dan are his own and do not necessarily represent the opinions of this station or any of the show's sponsors.
Okay, so here's the deal. If you want to know a little bit about oil, don't call and ask. Go back and listen to the last two segments. You'll at least learn it from my perspective for what it's worth. But there you have it. We're going to get to phones. Let me go to Vicky. Vicky's calling us from Virginia. Hey, Vicky.
Hey, Dan. I have one quick question. In the consumer staples sector, how many stocks should I have? I'm in the income portfolio. I'm retired, drawing RMDs.
Yeah, I would like you to have at least, at a minimum, three and a maximum of five or six. Folks, I just want to tell you, I'm at a little disadvantage here because I know Vicky and I know her portfolio a little bit. So don't say, well, you told that Vicky lady that it may not apply to everybody. But so anyway, I would say, you know, if you have three or four, that would be great. Four, preferably four. I think that would be great. If you have a couple more, that's fine. You know, one less, three, but at least three. At least three.
This is what I'm looking at. I had 38% in CS8080, and I was going to be going to another one in that division of 62, CS62, that you have on your buy list. And I thought, well, maybe I just better wait because I have so much in CS80. Because yeah. I didn't have my papers in front of me the last time I spoke to you.
Yeah, I mean, so that's going to really throw you over your weighting, right?
I have 38% in that one stock in that complete sector, just in that sector.
Yeah, I mean, are you up in the stock?
In that particular stock, nope. I bought when it was high. So,
okay.
So I have that one that I'm overweighted in, just in that sector again. You know, it's not 5%, so I mean, I'm not worried about that, but for that particular sector, I'm overweighted in that one stock from what I gathered the last time I spoke to you. So I was just asking.
And I think the other stock is paying more, a higher dividend, right?
The one that I have is paying the higher dividend, correct?
Oh, it is. Okay.
That's why I bought that particular one.
Yeah. I would just leave it alone, Vicky. I mean, either that or go ahead and buy the other one just for the sake of diversification. And watch CS80, and when it turns positive, which I believe it will, we're at great valuations right now. Mm-hmm. So when it turns positive, you know, I would say maybe sell some of it off, but I think that would be the way to go.
Okay, and I think, too, I had talked to you before, I was going to put my dividends into Christian Community Credit Union, and then that would be a large portion with that 4% on that CD. So I think that's what I'm going to do, and then wait to see what else you put on your buy list.
Okay, yeah, that would be great.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you so much. Thank you for all you do. We so appreciate you and pray for you.
Thank you, Vicky. I know you do, and I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Efer, Mississippi. Go ahead, Efren.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, thank you for your kingdom mentality and the work you do. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I have a TD Ameritrade, a Roth IRA, and actually I opened it at your advice a couple of years ago, and I started buying some individual, like from the Timothy plan, the large, small cap, international. Then I found out, not until I really buy thousands of dollars, I will be paying up front for those. So actually I stopped buying some of that. But I heard you the other day talking about TPLC.
Yes.
And I would like you to, if possible, you tell me a little bit about that. How do I do that? And I mean, is it diversifying out where I don't have to do anything else? I know.
How old are you, Efren?
I'm 47 years old.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it is diversified enough. that, I mean, you might want to take a look at TPHD as well. Maybe a combination of the two of them would give you some pretty decent diversification. How you do it is you just go to your, you know, TD Ameritrade account, and like you're buying a stock, click on whatever it is that you click on when you buy a stock, not a mutual fund, a stock, and put the symbol in there, and you'll be able to buy it.
All right. So do I get rid or just stop what I was doing buying the
I would definitely not get rid of that. Worst case would be to just to hold it. But if you, the nice thing about adding a little bit to it every once in a while, it really does help the fund. But I would not sell it.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate everything. I come from a socialist country, so I really not just enjoy, but learn a lot listening to you. And I'm sometimes at awe at how so many people in this great country want to go on the socialist way. I mean, it just blows my mind.
I know, Ivan, it's got to. And I wish all of you guys, I know I have a group of guys in Arkansas that call from time to time. They always come to our town hall meetings out there that are from Russia, and we have friends from the Ukraine and, you know, that have lived through some of those things. And, you know, I always say to them, I wish all of you could have a platform that you could get together and you know, beg people by telling them what it was like and how so much socialism ends up into dictatorship. And that you could share those thoughts with them. And I know that you must appreciate so much the opportunities.
Here, I would like to hear what some of the people that go for it now, what they will have to say if real tyranny comes to this country.
Yeah.
It'll be fun to hear what they have to say then.
I hope
it never comes, but appreciate your minister. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. Thank you so much. Yeah, good stuff. You know, it's so true.
It is, and we don't realize, you know, what we have, and that last comment is so true. So, yeah. And I've lived abroad, and I've seen it, and, you know, you've been to Russia, I've been to Russia. It's different. So, man,
it is. It's so hard. You know, I wish that, you know, I used to tell people, and I would have. Well, you might not have experienced. I'm sure at some point in time you did. I know you were in various places. But I used to tell people when they were passing or looking at Obamacare,
right.
I used to tell people, I said, look, here's the deal. Go overseas if you're visiting, whatever you're doing, and as great as it looks. Yep. And just, it's going to take you literally 30 seconds. Just stick your head in an emergency room door and take a look at socialism.
Yep.
I don't care if it's 11 o'clock at night. I've been in 4 emergency rooms overseas. Now, one wasn't, I wouldn't consider a developed country.
Right.
But stick your head in there, and it's unbelievable.
It is.
And I'm talking about the socialist countries that everybody is using as examples. Yep. You know, I have my brother-in-law, I was talking with him on Sunday. He has a house in Italy, and he goes over there often. And, you know, his wife is like, 23%. I don't know if she said 23 or 22. Yeah. I just left countries that were 25%.
Yep.
VAT tax on our food, on everything. You know, we're going to pay this VAT tax. I mean, it is people just, I wonder if some of those folks that are all for it don't, I guess I'm going to assume for a moment they're not stupid.
Correct.
So the only thing we can do is think they just don't know, right? Because surely if you knew, you wouldn't be so pro-socialism.
Yep,
and,
exactly right.
And I'll tell you, and I've said this, Bruce, so many times, that if we have one more election that is made up of Democrats only that win, we're going to have a VAT tax. And the VAT tax is going to start just like it did in Europe. In Europe, when it started, I think it was 0.2%. Right. Nobody cared. Who cared? 0.2%. It's 25% now. The key is, let's get the law passed. Yep. Then we can adjust it, right? And, you know, that's exactly what we're going to have. Because here's the deal, folks. Both Republicans and Democrats are okay with VAT tax. Yep. You know, there are many Republicans that are okay with that. So they won't have any trouble. We won't have any trouble getting a VAT tax passed for 0.2% or for even 1%. Right. It's not a problem. You know, we won't have any problem doing it. And then it can get adjusted up. Why? Because it's going to have to be. Yeah. It's going to have to be. And, you know, it's just, it's terrible. And too many people don't realize just how great it is.
Right.
You know, here, the only people that do are people like Ephraim and other people that I talk to that have lived there, that know it, that realize and understand it.
And see how much it costs for just a bucket of chicken.
It's a crazy. So. I was talking to a guy in Denmark 2 weeks ago. I met him on the street. Yeah. He and his wife were walking on the street. And he said hello to me, very good English. And I said hello back to him. And I said, where are you from? And I told him, we struck up a conversation. Sure. We had a great time. And he lived in California for years and years. And he said, if people only knew, if people only knew. Yep. He loved his country, but he said, if people ever knew.
I met a lady in Greece, same way. She worked for 25 years for a company in New York City. And then she was hawking Greek items.
We will never compromise our principles and standards. We will never give away our freedom. We will never abandon our belief in God.
Thank you for joining us. This has been an FISM production.